So happy to be able to introduce Philip. He is one of my primary teachers. And so it's a treat that Philip, through way before the pandemic, used to come in person to Seattle. And even during the pandemic, he came online and has continued. And I'm just looking here at the faces of many of you who I've seen in other contexts with Philip, but it's so beautiful that we are all together because of this pandemic. I mean, has a lot to do with why we are all here together on this annual event where Philip comes to Seattle Insight the first weekend in December and has been for many years. So we're grateful, Philip, that you have continued that, and may it continue forevermore. So it's very hard to introduce a teacher, especially a teacher like Philip, because I want to tell you some of the accomplishments, and I know that Philip is not all about the accomplishments, but some of you may not know Philip's accomplishments themselves in the Dhamma world, but he's been a teacher, I believe it's over 30 years. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but he's been a teacher. He's one of the senior teachers in this Insight lineage. He was a co-guiding teacher. In fact, I think he was one of the first co-guiding teachers, him and Sally Armstrong at Spirit Rock. And he did that from like 2010 to 2018, so quite a while, set in motion the growth of Spirit Rock. And he is, if you want to find some of his teachings and writings and the myriad of information and teachings that he shared with the world, you can find that on dhammawisdom.org, which is one of his websites. You can also find him. He's one of the founders. He's the founding teacher of Dharma Ground, which is some of the practice, the wisdom around his teachings in practice with nine bodies, with the arriving sequence that I'm assuming he will teach us over the course of this weekend, and choice, and all kinds of teachings that he's incorporated with the Four Noble Truths. And that information, you can find that on dharmaground.org. He also has a he's a founder of an institute, Life Balance Institute, which does a lot of work around changes and transitions that we all go through. It is a secular-based organization that's rooted in the Buddhist teachings on how to use that the Buddhist teachings in the nature of changes and transitions. And I hope at some point during the weekend he will share a little bit more about that, because it is a phenomenal piece of work for allowing us in our ordinary, regular life to apply the Dhamma in just our ordinary life. So a couple of books he's written, one about nine bodies, Awakening in Nine Bodies, a practice that I love. It's very close to my heart. Emotional Chaos to Clarity. It's rooted in that idea of going through changes and how to empower oneself, and then Dancing with Life, which many of us have studied for many, many years. So let me see. I think that's all I want to say about his accomplishments. But I want to say, this is not for Philip's ears. This is just for your ears. So don't say anything to him about what I'm saying now. But the thing that I think is the treat about coming to be with a weekend with Philip, unlike just spending a week practicing, is the really learning how to connect with the felt sense of your own experience, the felt sense of your own experience, and learning to appreciate the guide that comes from that experience. Learning to appreciate the wisdom that's already within you, so that we're not always trying to get wisdom from outside of us, but really learning how to get wisdom from within. I don't know any other teacher that can teach that as well as Philip does. And so I'm looking forward to the weekend. He said in our pre-meeting that he was going to do something different. So that makes it even more special. So, Philip, thank you for being here as usual. We really, really appreciate your time and the energy you put in our little sangha here in the Pacific Northwest.
Thank you, Tweri. You know, I've been with you so many years in a row that I feel very close to many of you, and I miss being there in person. Although I am aging out of travel, except under big necessity, so I don't know how many times I will get to be there again in my and the time that I continue to teach. But I do want you to know how much that I have felt welcomed and at home and a part of your sangha. And you know, we used to have those little, you remember, Tori, and many of you will remember this, but during your walking periods, we would have the small group meetings, and they were so jammed together, but people were so cut to the chase with their questions. And it was so rewarding, you know, for everybody. And there would be this sense of, oh, we just had an experience together. And I miss those too. And this community aspect of practice is so important, just so important. And we don't want to ever take it for granted. And from my own point of view, I was so dubious about being online and declared myself, I'm just not a Zoomer. And that was ignorance speaking, because once I surrendered to it, it actually has had many, many moments of feeling as though we are all together in a room. There, the deep connection I've witnessed occur time and time again. So we want to watch our attitude in terms of our view of our opinion versus the being available to the actual experience. And that leads me to the first preparatory remark that I want to make before we do our meditation. As Tori anticipated, tonight and throughout the retreat, I will often start a meditation with this preparatory practice of arriving. It's preliminary, it's preparatory, it is before we get interested in the objects that are arising in the mind. It's a cultivation of getting the mind established, the mind heart established in a way that we can receive our experience with wisdom and compassion. And I started doing this for myself somewhere in the early 2000s, maybe 2001 or somewhere right in there, and started teaching a little bit of this in 2004. But as I gained more confidence, I started doing this more and more in the teens, and it was very much helped by attending a retreat where the Venerable Anallio would do this. We would spend 45 minutes doing preparatory work before we actually turned to objects. So confirming of this. And I use this phrase of his, mindfulness front and center, over and over again. And I'm giving him credit right now, so I'll do it. I will give him credit again Saturday morning, because some people aren't here that will be there on Saturday morning, but very much to honor the interconnection of our teaching community in that way, and my great respect for him. The sequence of arriving is a three-part sequence. We connect to our intention to arise, that we are really making a choice to arrive in the moment, which is a courageous choice in itself, because we don't know what's going to arise in the moment. And oftentimes there is something unpleasant, something unsettled, something we're struggling with, that, or our body's tired or hurting, or our nervous system's too agitated. So well, why don't I want to arrive in the moment? There's a cartoon about that I can't remember the name of because I don't really see cartoons ordinarily, but it's a boy and a girl, and the boy is saying to the girl, well, I'm really committed to being in the moment, unless, of course, the moment sucks. And the girl says, yeah, that makes sense to me. And that's not the Dharma way. The Dharma way is we are not prejudicing the moment. We're not prejudicing overweighting conditions. We are prepared to be in the conditions as they do arise. And we believe that that is the way to having a sense of well-being, is by first being present. And then as we learn to arrive, we come to this state of being available to be present. And when we are present in that way, we are empowered by that, by that being available. And we have choice. And this is one of the realizations that we gain from being available. We realize that when we turn to all the experiences that are going to arise in the mind, heart, when we are available moment to moment, that we have choice of two kinds, the choice to stay with it and be there. And then if we realize it's not skillful, using right effort, one of the wise effort of the Eightfold Path and the Four Noble Truths, the Fourth Noble Truth, we direct attention away from it. That we can call that a getting out of dodge. And sometimes it's really wise to get out of dodge, you know, just like that cliche. It's too much. It's not helpful. But sometimes we can't. Sometimes it's so overwhelming that we are staying right where we are. If we're going to stay present, that's what we're going to stay present with. And if that's true, the second level of choice we have is how we're relating to what is overwhelming us, what's knocking us around, what's capturing us. And that is a choice that through practice we become ever more skillful with. The third part of this is aligning. We align with the Buddha, Dhamma, in whatever way is skillful for us. And I am always say at the beginning of this that for you, you may be new to the Buddha Dhamma, and that's really not what you can align with yet. So you align with your commitment to being a loving person, or your commitment to being truthful, or your commitment to living from your core values, but something where we align with. And why does this happen? Because if we don't, we can get overwhelmed by what we're being opening to, being available for. There's so many things that the mind does, as you've heard over and over again in Dharma talks in your own experience in sitting, that we really need the alignment for protection. But we also need the alignment for inspiration. We are inspired. We are cultivating standing in a certain position where we're receiving experience, and it's the place that will lead us towards a wholesome aspirations and intentional wise intentions, samasankappa. That, and so therefore it's needed, because we're always standing somewhere. And all of our experience, unless you're a Buddha, and that may be a whole different thing where you're everywhere at once and nowhere at once. I can imagine that, but I'm not sitting here saying I can do that in that way. But for the rest of us, we are standing somewhere, and the alignment is where we stand. We're in the standing in the way of the Satipatthana, where we've got those characteristics of the Satipatthana of mindfulness and clear comprehension and free from discontent and so forth, really available in the terms of the Satipatthana. If we were doing concentration, we could be available in the way of the Anapanasati Sutta, but we're available and aligned. You get this? Well, it's important. And it's very empowering. And the more we are in this, there's a stage after the aligning where the three become one, and uh, we are we are available and aligned, or aligned and available as a psychic heart field of attention. Maybe is one way to say that. Our psyche and our heart space, the nine bodies of consciousness are starting to line up. We'll get into that later in the weekend. And it's a real felt experience. I can remember with Anaya, when I was doing that retreat with him, when we were doing all this intensive practice on the preliminary, how my mind at some point, when I could feel, you know, and he was using very different means than what I use, having to do with all of these sutta reflections and all, more complicated, a lot to remember. And so you had to use papers and all to look at them. But that having really that arrived and aligned, how bountiful that is. And so often in my long sits at IMS, I would come to that with such deep appreciation. So I take the time to say this to you because I'm really encouraging you to consider, notice that, consider, not to do, but to consider, is this something I want to truly explore, not just do this evening or do the during the course of this weekend retreat, but to actually, like, I want to see if this really is something that could really make a kind of difference for me that Philip is suggesting. So this is an invitation, and one wants to consider invitations. At least I certainly do. I'm very motivated when someone says this is a consideration, as opposed to just one more of a series of points. This is a consideration. As a practitioner, how do I take that? Okay, so with that, we are now going to begin our meditation, and we're right on schedule. That's terrific. And so we will start with this, the arriving sequence, and then we'll go into our regular kind of meditation, starting with satipatthana of the body and noticing pleasant and unpleasant and so forth. And then I'm going to add an extra consideration. That's something, I just used that word because I'd used it earlier, an extra aspect of our experience in which to notice. And if it seems too much for you, just don't go with that extra consideration. It's just another way to explore the satipatthanas, but it may or may not work for you, and that's okay. And it's but another way of noticing our experience in a way that we have choice around our experience is another way I could say that. And so that's that. You will hear me say mindfulness front and center during the three A's. And by that, I do mean to bring up that intention of that mindfulness. That mindfulness is the bridge here. Mindfulness is the skillful means that allows insight to arise. It is not the insight itself. And that's why mindfulness can be used in a secular way also. And it is being so used in our culture right now, skillfully and unskillfully from my view, but nonetheless it is. But the insight is the Buddha's mindfulness practice is the mindfulness that's employed to bring insight. Insight in terms of the hindrances, the awakening factors, and the Four Noble Truths. That would be my understanding. Okay. Arriving here. arriving now. Arriving. Mindfulness front and center. Arriving. Here, this moment of where we are, the room in which you're sitting, the fact that we are in Sangha, in community, in this form, arriving into purpose. Arriving into practice here and now, employing mindfulness. There's a collecting of the mind and a unifying of the mind in arriving. You can energetically feel that happening. Arriving in the moment has priority over what you might be experiencing. So the experiences that are arising in the mind from the five senses are still going on, of course, but we're not prioritizing them, but rather it's establishing this knowing quality of sati, of mindfulness. At some point, we feel that we are in the moment. We can feel the immediacy of the moment. This is a metric of means, a skillful means for recognizing that mindfulness is beginning to be established, is that we are feeling the immediacy of just now, just here. As this grows, we start to recognize that we are present. We really can have a felt sense of being present for that immediacy. We are present, we have a felt sense of it, and we know we have a felt sense. So wholesome. Sometimes that feeling of being present leads to a field of presence, that we are in the field of presence. We are, the mindfulness is so established that they have this felt sense of presence. That knowing is so established. You don't have to be doing this for hours or days or weeks or months. It may be short-lived, but this sense of being present and having a presence, not as a me or my, but as a field of knowing. Delicious. And so we know we are available. We recognize we're available. We're mindful of it. We have a felt sense of what it means to be available in this mindful way. The heart quality may enter here. The vulnerability may enter. a sense of possibility may enter, our humanness. We realize when we're available that there's natural curiosity, that a receptivity is part of being available, a responsiveness. It can be exciting, empowering, feel a little scary, like maybe opening more in a way that you're not accustomed to. Curious. Present. It can be skillful to spend the entire meditation period just starting to explore available. But before we would do that, we would recognize this vulnerability, because the mind can go anywhere, have any thought, fall into any kind of a wanting, any kind of an aversion, in time of the confusion. We know this is just the nature of it. So we don't judge it or compare it or fix it, but we do protect ourselves through realizing we have choice and we choose to align our availability with the Dhamma or with our core values, our deepest truth. And so we move from being just available, but to aligning. You can align with the Buddha. You can align with the wholesome activity of the Sangha. You can align with your faith in the Dhamma, the truth of the Buddha's teaching, and your ability to recognize what's true through mindful discernment. I align with the wisdom factors of the Eightfold Path personally. Wise view, which I call wise aspiration, and wise intention, which is how one intends to be this very moment, here and now. I wish to reflect the values that the Buddha taught. Non-harming, metta, and renunciation. So say to yourself what you're aligning with. Don't be vague, please. Be specific. May I align with? At some point, there arises at least the hint of being aligned and available, or available aligned, depending on how your mind experiences the integration of those two. Arriving is like established, such that this available aligned, aligned, available. You can feel, maybe not tonight as your first time, but you can feel it as a kind of ground. I term it the first ground, this preparatory, preliminary grounding. So wholesome. Even a hint is satisfying. A hint of a hint is satisfying. Assume what you're feeling is in the correct direction. Don't second guess. Don't look for proof. Stay in the felt sense of your mindfully choosing. This is a clue. A surrendering to your own wholesomeness. You don't have to do it. It's in you. You're connecting to what is already there. Sometimes there will be a feeling that's physical. Sometimes the felt sense is more energetic. Sometimes the felt sense of aligned and available is emotional. These three different dimensions of manifest consciousnesses. And now we're ready to turn to the objects that arise in the mind spontaneously. We will direct attention, but oftentimes the mind doesn't stay where we direct or doesn't even bother to go there. And it's all fine because we relate to what the mind is experiencing, the mind heart. And so we turn to the body. We aim our attention at the body. We sustain our attention on the body experience. The felt sense of body. So you may feel this as the form that the body's sitting in, or lying in, or standing in. Or it may be you feel it as a field of sensations, or one sensation. This felt sense. The first Satipatthana, staying mindful of the body till one knows there is a body. That's a felt sense the Buddha's pointing to, not an intellectual recognition. We all know that all the time. Notice when a view or opinion about the body arises. And then what we do, how we start to have a judging of it or comparing of it or wanting to fix it or plan to fix it in the future or complain about it or feel sorry for ourselves. Human, just human doing. Not to be judged, not to be compared, but not to be swept away by either. A benign attitude towards this body, an attitude of gratitude, an attitude of curiosity. In this very physical body, we can feel the phenomena of aliveness. So we turn to the breath, the movement of the breath. This breath is the very felt experience directly of aliveness. It ties in, is recognized through this vital body of consciousness, the consciousness that can recognize our life force, recognize our vitality. In relation to the physical body, in relation to this level of vitality, we have an outer experience through the sense gates of body. Is this not true? Whatever we're experiencing of body, whatever we experience of the breath as movement, you can notice the temperature of the body, whether the body's tired, the stillness in the body, the parts of the body. The sense experience. This is our outer experience. There's also an inner experience of the body, an internal. It's more subjective. It's your felt sense. Body. Maybe feel a little more ephemeral, but not less real. In this body and breath, there's a flavoring of each moment of it, of pleasant or unpleasant, or neither pleasant nor unpleasant. The outer experience that moment of feeling an ache in the shoulder is an outer experience, external. The way it registers. That ache has an internal experience, subjective. That the body is aching is objective. But there's an internal experience. Sometimes the unpleasantness of the body ache, when we look at the internal experience, the subjective experience, actually we don't really mind that much. We were just getting caught in the stimulation, the sensory experience of an aching body, but actually it's just not that. If we weren't sitting still, we wouldn't have noticed it. And we realize we have an external experience, an outer experience, and an internal experience. And our mind moves between those two so quickly that we tend to merge them together. Just even around the body and its moments of Vedana, the second of the Satipatthanas. The felt sense, how it's internally experienced. So much more freedom. If you've fallen down and hurt your leg or cut your leg or something, that's a fact. We can all look at your leg and agree that your leg is cut and bleeding. But how you're experiencing that inside, we could not see how it feels to you, your felt sense of it. So mysterious. What creates that? Maybe that is where the freedom is, the Buddha's freedom. The happiness of the Buddha is in developing freedom of this subjective internal experience. Just maybe. We start to understand some of the Buddha's teachings in a different way. They're more comprehensible. They're more felt than intellectually understood. Oh, I have choice in relation to my felt experience and how I relate to it. Oh, And then we forget. And then someone reminds us, or we rediscover it. The fourth foundation of mindfulness teaches us that. How to rediscover. Knowing the Dhamma, the things of our experience, of the body, of pleasant and unpleasant, and of our mind and emotional states, or mind states and the emotions that come with them, and the thoughts that come with them. They are in that third foundation of mindfulness. And we can see even in that third foundation of our mind states and our emotions that come with them, that they too have a felt sense as well as this sense feeling. So the heat of anger, how anger is so can take over the mind, but we can also go, oh, what is this felt sense? What is my internal experience? I'm definitely angry. But what does anger feel like? Oh. Or confusion. Or wanting. We can feel that we can have this wanting. The mind is just filled with wanting of something. But then what is that actually? What's the felt sense of that? What is the sense gate of the mind is filled with wanting? Flushed with wanting. But how do I experience that wanting? So often we discover that our outer experience is misleading us. It's just reacting to conditions as it's been trained to do. it's been conditioned to do. But our internal experience has a lot more space around it. This is true if you're 25 or 75. It doesn't matter if you start discovering this at 25 or 45 or 75. It's not too late. It's not too early. That's an unskillful consideration, how old we are. The consideration is what matters to us, and do we have the opportunity to develop more clarity, more choice? Clarity as to what values we have. Clarity is what skillful means and why we would practice. When the mind wanders, you can stay there with where it's been drawn to if it's strong. If not, just let it flow back gently but firmly to the breath body. If it stays there, notice. What is the sense gate of it experience? What in terms of the five senses and the mind as the sixth versus the felt experience? And when it gets tired, go back or distracted, go back to the breath, please. Just maybe now or later, you will realize on the inner experience that you have more a sense of spaciousness, something that you're used to maybe really if you settle down for a long time. But actually, it was always there. This inner knowing of the felt sense. Creates perspective. You are both more fully participating in the experience of the senses, but you're also knowing, observing them with the spaciousness of the knowing. The knowing is stronger, it's more. It's more present without you ever having to think that. You just feel, oh, I am including the inner experience more. when you're back at the breath. You might have a foretaste of what in the Anapanasati is called the beautiful breath. This sutta on breath is meditation. The breath becomes, as a felt sense, alive, satisfying. The mind is so content around this simple, ever-changing experience of the breath. And you just smile. No me or mine in it. Nothing to grab hold of. Just gratitude. And being available to it. I'm in line to attitude. That really allows you to be available. Available in mind and available in heart. You're not figuring out why the heart is content. That's thinking again. You're having a felt sense of a contented heart. And a mind that's not grasping. If the mind starts wandering off, as best you can, remind yourself of the felt sense. You may be tired a long day, and don't over-effort. Just let it be as it is. But if there's liveliness, if there's curiosity, if there's energy present, then feel you're aligned, available. And be available to this kind of knowing. It's simple because it's felt sense. Doesn't require any thinking. Just being available and aligned. Beginner's mind is so beautiful. If you fall into this feeling of contentment, it's not out of your league. It's what's naturally there, and you had the good fortune to fall into it. This beautiful breath. This contented mind felt sense, felt sense. Available, available, aligned. With beginner's mind, we don't have to be doing the concepts all the time of the teachings. If we've prepared ourselves, we truly are available, you know? I mean, sometimes a lot available. Just, wow, thanks for that. When we've in our dedication as practitioners, it can be we're doing the form, the outer experience, and we don't give ourselves permission for that spontaneity of just turning towards the inner experience. Whether we start with the outer or start with the inner, we don't, and it's all felt. But sometimes that just happens. And it's like, you know, when you first go bowling or something and you roll all these strikes and you go, all this bowling is easy. And then you spend the next 3 years, you never do it as well. That's because the body has a naturalness that you haven't, your trying hasn't gotten in the way yet, if something like that's happened to you. And then of course we our minds impose and we get in our own way. Almost all of us, maybe there's some exceptions, but most of us. So we're going to take our little break now, and I will give a short little further explanation of what I've been pointing to tonight, and then mostly it's going to be your questions about anything you want to bring up. It doesn't have to be about the inner and the outer or the arriving sequence. It could be about dealing with the world. See you in 10 minutes. So at 8, let's call it 8:20. We'll give an extra minute in there. These Friday evenings are both an offering in themselves, a kind of I don't know what word to use, a little condensed version of the whole weekend retreat. And they're also an introduction, a kind of setting the pattern if you're attending the whole retreat, so that there's themes and feelings, felt sense feelings evoked that then get elaborated on and developed through the weekend. And we don't have to kind of grab hold of any of these things. We just stay with them. I think my remarks this evening are, and I will repeat some of them tomorrow, and they relate to the Four Noble Truths, which is my base reference, which, you know, I received as a deep teaching from the Venerable Sumedho. And so I tend to, once I had a shift in perspective, that therefore I tend to see things from the Four Noble Truths point of view. I'm not asking that you do that. It's just that we all do know the Four Noble Truths, at least most of us. And so even if that's not your frame of reference as much as it is mine, nonetheless, it's one we share in common. And so I want to talk about the outer and the inner experience, and I will do this throughout the weekend. And the outer, inner, objective, subjective, and so forth, as a way of practicing, of noticing what we practice, a way of freeing ourselves when we're stuck, when we're caught in an eddy and so forth. But to start with, the first noble truth, that there is dukkha. There is dukkha. Surely no one living in this moment in time would have any confusion about that, because there is so much dukkha, and some of that has to do with deteriorating situations, which we not only feel for ourselves, but our kids and our grandkids and all of those that are to come, and the earth itself, and the rise of anti-democracy that's around the world and so forth. So on a macro level, but then in our own experience of what it is to be a human being, how difficult it is to be a human being, how it requires, from a Dharma point of view, acknowledging, you know, the Buddha's worldly winds of gain and loss, of pain and pleasure, fame and ill repute, praise and blame. It's the nature of the realm. And we can get defeated by this. We can have an attitude that's not the cultivated attitude of the Dharma. It becomes a reaction to the sense gate experience we're receiving in the world. The outer experience can lead us to a lack of learned helplessness, to a futility, and so forth. And we human beings are very available to have that experience. And therefore, the hindrances of mind, the wanting, the aversion, kind of collapsed feeling of that sloth and torpor, the restlessness and worry, that's also another part of the collapsed, and the delusion, that's part of the collapsed feeling that can occur, those hindrances. It's natural that we're subject to that. I want to give you a quote from James Baldwin that expresses his recognition that we human beings have this tendency to get lost, to give up on ourselves, and his own perspective about it. And it comes from his book, The Fire Next Time, which I guess I was trying to remember when I first read that. I think I was 20 years old or something, but that may not be correct. It was so long ago that I just can't remember, and very much affected by that book. So he says, time and again, the people discover that they have merely betrayed themselves in the hands of yet another Pharaoh, who, since he was necessary to put the broken country together, will not let them go. This can be external or it can be internal. Time and again, the people discover they have merely betrayed themselves in the hands of yet another Pharaoh. Again, external, which we have a lot of in the world right now, internal, which we all have our own inner Pharaoh, who, since he was necessary, it could be she was necessary, they were necessary, to put the broken country, put ourselves, our sense of self, together, will not let them go. Perhaps people being the conundrums that they are and having so little desire to shoulder the burden of their lives, this is what will always happen. Hear this, please. Perhaps people being the conundrums that they are, all of us, this is my words, you can tell when I'm putting my words in. Perhaps people being the conundrums they are and having so little desire to shoulder the burdens of their lives, this is what will always happen. This is the first two noble truths. The collapse under the existence of dukkha. And why does that collapse? Because of the conditions of the mind that's pointed to in the second noble truth. But at the bottom of my heart, I do not believe this. I think that people can be better than that. And I know that people can be better than they are. We are capable of bearing a great burden once we discover that burden is reality and arrive where reality is. Arrive where reality is. We have the burden of being a human being. There is no escaping it if we wish to stay present. There is no escaping having an experience of the felt sense of that burden, the the first two noble truths. There's no escaping the first noble truths if we want to be present in our lives. If we want to live a full felt sense of our lives, from my perspective and obviously from Baldwin's, there's no escaping this. Nor do I think we should. You know, it's set up this way. Our dukkha is not a mistake. Our dukkha, both personally and a community and a collective and a culture and the world, is the nature of this realm. So it's not a mistake. And it happens too much to be like, oh, well, this is just somehow a little mistake or something that happens frequently. It is entwined in, just as the Buddha says. It's entwined in. It's not that all is dukkha. It's that it's interwoven with the experience. The worldly winds. The heart that's joyous and the heart that gets broken. It's what we do with that experience. We are better than that. And I know that people can be better than they are. We're capable of bearing a great burden. Once we discover that burden is reality and arrive where reality is, we recognize what's being called for. The Venerable Sumedho would talk about it as being willing to stand under dukkha. Anyway, the point here is that we are living in an age of revolution, whether we will or no, that the America is the only Western nation with both the power and, as I hope, to suggest the experience that may help us make these revolutions real and minimize the human damage. Any attempt we make to oppose these outbursts of energies is tantamount to signing our own death warrant. I come more and more to believe that if human beings are going to survive, it's each individual that survives. Each individual that makes the choice to embrace suffering and to move through suffering. You may have a different view. I used to believe that because I was a person who could create systems, I used to believe that the answer was in systems because it was too big that we had to use systems. But boy, in a human life, If each human being that's in that system, and certainly any human being that has any degree of empowerment, any power, if they're off, you know, the system breaks down in 1,000 little pieces. So my perspective on this, and I'm here to help you this weekend with your understanding, the empowerment of your system. The empowerment of you as an individual claiming your own empowerment to choose, to recognize you have choice and to choose. To choose what? Non-suffering over suffering. But the way out, unfortunately, is the way through. I want to read you a couple lines from T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets. And this is from the part that's called Burt Norton. I'm not saying that right. I'm stumbling here. Burt Norton. And it starts, it's very short. And it's where he's talking about stillness, the stillness that the Buddha is pointing to. And he is describing the well-being, the freedom of mind, heart that comes when we've let loose of all those hindrances, and the mind is in stillness. The mind is collected and unified, and the mindfulness is front and center. And he describes it as the inner freedom from the practical desire. The inner freedom from the practical desire. The release from action and suffering. Release from the inner and outer compulsion, yet surrounded by a grace of sense, a white light still in movement, still in moving. The inner freedom from the practical desire, that's the outer. We have practical desires. It's not that the practical desires are the problem. It's our relationship to the practical desires, the outer experience, what's called for in our outer experience, the inner freedom from the practical desire, the release from action, doing, little Pac-Man, doing, wanting this, wanting that. But we all do. The release from action and suffering, release from the inner and the outer compulsion. What does it mean, these outer compulsions? We're having another way of understanding clinging. This outer compulsion, that's our clinging, that's our grasping from the outer compulsions. The release from the inner and the outer compulsion. What is the inner compulsion? We're going to explore that various ways. We're going to what I call circumambulate it, which is what if you get the ever privilege of going to the Mahabodhi temple, what one does is what one walks around and around this beautiful temple. There's, I don't know, hundreds, thousands of Buddhas everywhere, little Buddha statues everywhere. And at one end of it is the Bodhi tree. And where supposedly the Buddha sat when he was awakened. So you walk around and around it, and you're circumambulating it. And the image I have for myself is I'm spiraling in deeper and deeper, available each step as I circumambulate to a deeper understanding of further communion. And so it is with the inner and the outer compulsion, this challenge of the second noble truth, looked at from a different way than maybe you've heard it before or even experienced in yourself, seeing your own outer compulsions in a non-judging way. We're not going, oh, how terrible, I got these outer compulsions. That's ridiculous. That's ridiculous. That's delusion. That's a judging mind. That's judging compared to what? I mean, what does it mean? Like you would judge it, but that you would recognize it is discernment. That we would each recognize it as discernment. And that discernment, and I will repeat this tomorrow because it is so important, that discernment leads to wisdom and compassion. And this inner compulsion, what is the inner experience? The clue, the means, skillful means, lies in becoming aware of the felt experience. From my point of view, other people would have other points of view, but this point of view is a vehicle, works. It works for people gaining understanding and gaining choice. So it works. I'm not trying to, it's not the point of view. I'm not attached to view in that way. It's not reliable to be attached to view. So, and then when we have this release from the inner and the outer compulsion, something kind of wonderful happens. Surrounded by a grace of sense, a white light, still and moving. He goes on, eribun, meaning exhilaration without motion, concentration without elimination, what the Venerable Sumedho will describe as that we start out with a single point of awareness, and then as our practice develops, well, there come those moments when that one-pointedness is the one point that includes everything. Beautiful experience when it happens. So, that is the direction of our practice this weekend.